The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. You are a gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into something foundational. We're plunging into one of the most, well, radical and influential books in political history, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's The Social Contract. It came out way back in 1762.
It really is a landmark text. I mean, this is the book that arguably set the intellectual stage for huge democratic revolutions. It tackles, you know, the ultimate question: how can we live together in society with all its rules and laws without just giving up our essential freedom?
Exactly. And he frames it with that incredibly famous line right at the start: man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. That's the puzzle he sets out to solve.
Right.
So our mission today is to unpack how Rousseau tries to replace those illegitimate chains, things like absolute monarchy or rule by conquest, with what he sees as legitimate constraints, chains we put on ourselves, somehow making us freer.
Yeah, it sounds like a paradox, doesn't it? How can constraints make you free? But that's the core of his argument we need to explore.
Okay, but before we get to the how, let's talk about the who. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, quite a character, wasn't he? Lived 1712 to 1778.
Oh, definitely. A Genevan philosopher, writer, even a composer. He was, well, complex, full of contradictions, really. Right smack in the middle of the Enlightenment.
But what made him different? Because the Enlightenment was all about reason, progress.
Right. And Rousseau was certainly part of that. He used reason, but he was also one of his biggest critics. You had figures like Voltaire championing science and progress. And then Rousseau comes along extolling the virtues of nature, simplicity, even emotion. He was deeply skeptical about whether civilization was actually good for us.
Interesting tension there. And his background in Geneva, that Republican city-state, that influenced him heavily, right?
Hugely. You see it in his ideas about civic virtue. And remember, he already written his discourse on inequality, where he argued that things like private property were the root of corruption and conflict, that they took us away from a more innocent natural state.
So the discourse diagnosed the illness.
Exactly. And the social contract is his attempt at the cure. It's his blueprint for a political society designed to get us back to, or maybe create for the first time, a kind of moral freedom within society.
Okay, let's get into that blueprint then. The social contract isn't really describing how governments were back then, is it?
No, not at all. It's prescriptive. It's about how a just state should be formed, what its legitimate foundations are. He's not interested in justifying the status quo. He wants to tear it down conceptually.
So how does he start? By rejecting existing power structures.
Pretty much. He systematically dismantles the common justifications for authority. He says it doesn't come from nature. The whole father knows best model applied to kings. He rejects that. It definitely doesn't come from force. He famously mocks the right of the strongest, saying might doesn't make right.
So if it's not nature, not force, not conquest, what's left?
Only one thing: agreement. A voluntary, unanimous agreement by everyone to form a society for mutual protection and benefit. That's the social contract.
And this agreement creates something new, right? This collective body.
Yes, the sovereign. And this is crucial. The sovereign isn't a king or a parliament. The sovereign is the entire community of citizens acting together. It's the collective us.
Okay, the collective us. And what guides the sovereign?
This is maybe his most famous and trickiest concept,
The
general will. The idea is that this collective body, when acting as the sovereign, is always aimed at the common good, not individual desires, but what's best for everyone.
And the ultimate goal is freedom through obedience.
In a sense, yes. It's about reconciling individual liberty with the authority of the state by saying true freedom, what he calls moral freedom, is actually obeying a law that you yourself, as part of the sovereign, have helped create. You're obeying yourself, collectively speaking.
Okay, that sets the stage. Let's dive into Book Eye then, where he actually lays out the details of this contract. How does it work?
Well, he starts from the idea that individuals alone are pretty vulnerable. To survive and prosper, they need to cooperate. This leads them to make the pact. And the core of the pact is a kind of total surrender.
Total surrender. That sounds alarming. Surrender of what?
Of your unlimited natural liberty, the freedom to do absolutely anything you want, limited only by your own strength, like in a hypothetical state of nature. You give this up to the community.
Why would anyone agree to that? A total surrender?
Because everyone does it equally. That's the key safeguard. No one is above the law or the contract because everyone is part of making it. His formulation is precise. Each of us puts his person and all his power in common under the supreme direction of the general will.
And in doing this, you create the state, the body politic.
Exactly. And the individual isn't just giving things up. They gain something potentially better. They trade that chaotic natural liberty for two other kinds. First, civil liberty. Freedom within the bounds of the law, protected by the community.
Okay, freedom under law. That makes sense. What's the second?
Moral liberty. And this is really interesting. For Rousseau, this is true freedom becoming master of oneself, overcoming your base impulses and appetites to act according to reason and the common good. Society, through the general will, helps you achieve this.
So this leads us to that really controversial phrase, forced to be free, if someone doesn't want to follow the general will.
Rousseau says the community, the sovereign, can compel them. He writes that whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be constrained to do so by the entire body, which means nothing other than that he shall be forced to be free.
That just sounds authoritarian, doesn't it? How do we make sense of that today?
It's probably the most debated part of the book. One way to think about it is like self-discipline. You know, your rational self decides it's good for you to go to the gym. Your impulsive self wants to stay in bed.
Right.
When you drag yourself to the gym, you're kind of forcing your impulsive self to obey your rational self's decision. Right. For Rousseau, the general will represents that higher rational collective self. By making you follow the laws you agreed to as part of the social contract, the community is actually liberating you from being a slave to your own selfish or short-sighted impulses.
Okay. Framing it as liberation from internal slavery to impulse, that helps. It's still a tricky concept, though.
Very tricky. And easily misused, historically.
Let's move into book two. This gets into the nature of that guiding force, the general will, and sovereignty itself. You mentioned it's not just what everyone wants added up.
Correct. He's very clear. The general will is not the will of all. The will of all is simply the sum total of private interests. Like, if 51% of people vote for a policy that only benefits them personally, that's the will of all, potentially, but it might not be the general will.
So the general will is?
It's what emerges when citizens think about the common interest, the good of the whole community. It's the overlapping consensus, perhaps. What's left when you strip away the purely selfish, conflicting desires, it always aims, by definition, for the public good.
And because it's this pure collective thing, sovereignty itself has certain characteristics.
Yes. Because it represents the general will, sovereignty must be inalienable. The people cannot give away or transfer their ultimate lawmaking power to anyone else, not even representatives.
Whoa, okay. That has huge implications for modern democracy.
Absolutely. And it must also be indivisible. You can't split up sovereignty. There's one ultimate source of law, the assembled people guided by the general will.
This all sounds incredibly idealistic. How does a society, especially a new one, actually figure out what the general will is on complex issues? Do people just magically know?
Rousseau recognized this problem. People might be clouded by their private interests or lack the foresight needed. This leads him to introduce a rather strange figure, the lawgiver.
The lawgiver. Who's that? Sounds almost mythical.
It kind of is. He points to figures like Lycurgus in Sparta or Solon in Athens, these almost superhumanly wise individuals who he thinks are necessary uniquely at the founding of a state to propose the initial set of fundamental laws and institutions.
Wait, so you need this genius outsider to tell people what their general will should be. Doesn't that contradict the whole idea of the people being sovereign?
It seems like a huge tension, yeah. But crucially, the lawgiver has no political power themselves. They can only propose the laws. It's still the sovereign, the people who must freely vote on and ratify those laws. The lawgiver is like an architect who draws up the plans, but the people have to approve them and then live in the house.
A necessary, temporary guide, maybe? Still feels a bit awkward in a system.
It definitely highlights the difficulty of actually establishing this ideal republic from scratch.
Okay, let's move to book three, which deals with government. He makes a really important distinction here, doesn't he? Between the sovereign and the government.
Absolutely critical distinction. The sovereign is the people as a collective, holding the legislative power. They make the laws based on the general will. The government is merely the executive power.
So the government is just the hired help.
Pretty much. It's an agent, an intermediary body, set up to apply the laws made by the sovereign to specific cases. Think of the sovereign as the board of directors setting the company's mission and rules. The government is like the CEO and management team hired to carry out those rules.
And Rousseau warns that this management team has its own interests.
Constantly. This is the inherent danger in any republic, according to him. The government, being a smaller group with its own corporate will, naturally tends to try and accumulate more power and eventually usurp the authority of the sovereign. It wants to become the lawmaker, not just the law applier.
So how do you prevent that? Does he have a preferred form of government?
He analyzes the traditional forms, democracy, aristocracy, monarchy, based on who holds that executive power. He actually dismisses pure democracy, where the people are both legislature and executive, as basically impossible for humans. He says it requires such constant virtue and attention, it's fit for gods, not men, too prone to civil war.
Interesting. So what does he favor?
He leans towards elective aristocracy as the best practical form. This means the citizens elect the wisest and most capable individuals to form a government and execute the laws. Not a hereditary aristocracy, but one based on merit and election.
But even with an elected government, how do you stop that power creep he warned about?
Active citizenship. He insists the only way to keep the government in check is through regular, periodic assemblies of all citizens. In these assemblies, the people must directly reaffirm the social contract itself and have the power to review and potentially dismiss the government.
So constant vigilance and participation are required. You can't just elect and forget.
Absolutely not. For Rousseau, sovereignty cannot be represented, and active participation is the lifeblood of the republic.
Okay, that takes us to the final part, Book 4. This covers how to maintain the state and includes some more controversial ideas.
Yes, Book 4 deals with things like voting mechanisms, how to ensure voting actually expresses the general will. He argues citizens need to be well-informed and vote based on what they genuinely believe is the common good, not just their private advantage. But then he gets into what holds the whole thing together morally and socially.
And this is where the civil religion comes in.
Exactly. He was actually quite critical of traditional Christianity, arguing it created divided loyalties. You know, rendering unto Caesar and rendering unto God could put citizens in conflict. So he proposes a minimal civil religion.
A state-sponsored religion, what does it involve?
It's very simple, really. Yeah. Basic dogmas, like belief in a benevolent God who ensures justice, belief in an afterlife where the just are rewarded and the wicked punished, and crucially, belief in the sanctity of the social contract and the laws.
Wait, so you have to believe these things to be a good citizen. What's the purpose?
It's purely political,
yeah,
according to him. The goal isn't theological truth or saving souls. It's about fostering the sentiments of sociability and civic duty needed to maintain the state. It's about making people reliable members of the community in this life.
And if you don't believe, or if you pretend to believe but act against the state.
That's where it gets harsh. He suggests that someone who publicly acknowledges these dogmas, but then acts as if they don't believe them by being a bad citizen, could be punished, even banished, or in extreme cases, put to death not for impiety, but for breaking the social bond.
Wow. That definitely sounds illiberal to modern ears. It shows how seriously he took social cohesion as the foundation for freedom.
It does. It's a stark reminder that his conception of liberty was deeply embedded in the community, not purely individualistic.
Okay, let's try to pull back and summarize the really big themes, the key takeaways for someone learning about this today. What stands out?
Well, first and foremost, it has to be popular sovereignty. The idea that ultimate political authority rests only with the people as a whole. That was revolutionary. And it's the bedrock of modern democratic theory, even if we practice it differently than he envisioned.
Right. It's not granted by God or inheritance. It comes from the governed. What's next?
The general will. Even if it's hard to define perfectly, this concept forces us to think beyond just adding up individual preferences, the will of all. It challenges us to ask, what is the genuine common interest here? It pushes against pure factionalism and self-interest in politics.
A call to think collectively, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. Third, his sharp critique of representation. His argument that sovereignty cannot be represented is a direct challenge to how most modern democracies work.
He famously said that English people were only free during elections.
Exactly. As soon as they elected their representatives, he argued, they became enslaved again because they'd given away their lawmaking power. It really makes you question our reliance on representatives and whether it fosters passivity.
And the fourth big one has to be that paradox we discussed.
The paradox of freedom, yes, being forced to be free. It's this challenging idea that true freedom isn't just doing whatever you feel like, which he saw as slavery to appetite, but is actually self-mastery, living according to laws you rationally give yourself as part of the community.
It connects freedom with reason and self-control.
Precisely.
Rousseau certainly knew how to coin a phrase, Some of his lines just stick with you, don't they?
Absolutely. He had a real gift for capturing these huge ideas memorable. You've got to start with the opener.
Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. Instantly sets up the whole problem he's trying to solve, the gap between our natural state and our social reality.
Then there's his powerful defense of why liberty matters so fundamentally. To renounce liberty is to renounce being a man, to surrender the rights of humanity and even its duties. For him, freedom isn't just nice to have, it's essential to our very humanity and morality.
You can't trade it away.
No. And finally, that defining paradox. Whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be constrained to do so by the entire body, which means nothing other than that he shall be forced to be free. Again, deeply controversial, but central to his idea of freedom as rational self-governance over mere impulse.
Okay, so these are big theoretical ideas, but how can we actually apply them? Do they have relevance in, say, modern life or organizations?
I think they absolutely do. Take the general will versus the will of all. We can use that lens to analyze political debates constantly. Is a proposed policy genuinely aimed at the long-term common good, or is mostly serving powerful special interests, lobbying groups, the loudest parts of the will of all?
So it's a tool for critical thinking about policy, asking who really benefits.
Exactly. And his warning about the government usurping the sovereign. You see that dynamic in all sorts of organizations. Think about a member-led association or even a company with shareholders. The sovereign, member shareholders, sets the overall mission. The government management executes it. Is management staying true to the mission or pursuing its own power and interests?
That's a great analogy, the board versus the CEO dynamic.
Yeah, and personally, that forced to be free idea really resonates with self-discipline. We constantly make social contracts with ourselves, right? I will exercise more, I will save money. Then our short-term impulses, our natural liberty to be lazy or spend, rebel. When we stick to our plan, we are essentially forcing our impulsive self to obey the law, our rational self prescribed. That's achieving moral freedom over base desire in a very Rousseauian way.
It's about aligning your actions with your own rational commitments. That makes a lot of sense.
So what's the final takeaway for you? What really stands out after diving back into Rousseau?
For me, it's the sheer uncompromising idealism. He refuses to accept the easy trade-off, you know, give up some freedom for security or order. He demands both through this very specific demanding structure. It feels like a constant challenge. Democracy isn't something you have, it's something you do actively all the time.
Yeah, that active participation is key. What surprised me again, or maybe struck me most forcefully this time, was that critique of representation. It really makes you question modern citizenship. Are we truly sovereign if we mostly just delegate our power away? It feels uncomfortable, but important to think about. How much have we accepted being passive subjects rather than active citizens?
It's a powerful question to leave with. His work is definitely not a comfort read, but it forces you to examine the very foundations of political life.
Absolutely. A timeless challenge.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.